Welcome to the Ad Nauseam Podcast, where classical gourmands everywhere can finally get their fill. Join us for a delectable discussion of Greco-Roman civilization stretching from the Minoans and Mycenaeans through the Renaissance and right down to the present. And now, ladies and gentlemen, here are your hosts, Dr. David Noe and Dr. Jeff Winkle.
Welcome, listeners, to episode 18 of the Ad Nauseam Podcast. My name is Jeff Winkle. I'm here in the vomitorium with my co-host, Dave Noe. How are you doing today, Dave?
I'm doing really well, Jeff. Thank you.
Are you excited about this new year that we're in?
I am. It seems like just a year ago we started this podcast.
And here
we are, up to the 18th episode.
That's incredible.
Yeah. I'm really eager for today's because it's one of those unique topics that doesn't get mentioned a lot. It's quite specific. It's down and a little bit fine-grained. It's a good way to start off the year, I would say.
I think so. And I mean, I don't want to make any assumptions or insult our audience, but I'm guessing this is probably...
I'm willing to go there.
Right. But I'm guessing that this is a topic that they probably don't know much about.
Right.
And so this will be a new thing for a lot of our listeners.
Well, and a topic that doesn't get covered a lot.
Right.
The concept of memory... Let's face it, and we can talk about this more later on, but memory is not really at a premium in contemporary society.
There's no need for memory, some people would say, because information is at your fingertips all the time.
That's right. We live in the information age, after all.
Right. I think we're getting ahead of things. So we got a shout out to get to.
Yes, so we want to say hello to Stephen Post, who lives right here nearby in Ada, Michigan. He and his family are loyal listeners of the podcast, I hear. So hello, Stephen. Thanks for tuning in.
Thanks, Stephen. And you got a quote to open us up today.
I do. This quote is from the late Francis Yates. Francis Yates was a wonderful English scholar, a woman who taught in London for a very long time, and she died in 1981, I understand. She wrote this work called The Art of Memory. This is University of Chicago Press, published in 1966. And this is what she says. William Perkins was absolutely right in seeing the Bruno Dixon artificial memory in a context of Catholic versus Protestant attitude to images. For whilst Bruno, the heretical magus of memory, could, and did, develop out of pious medieval use of the images of the art of memory, the Protestant inner and outer iconoclasm arrested the possibility of any such development.
Well, you know, in terms of like nicknames, you could do a lot worse than the Magus of Memory.
Yes, you could.
That is awesome.
Well, this is a wonderful book. Francis Yates wrote this, The Art of Memory. There's a companion volume on Giordano Bruno in particular, and we'll talk about that later. But this quote pulls out some really interesting aspects that we are going to cover in this episode. So the overall theme is art of memory. How does one remember things? How ought to? And then it's specifically in the context of the 16th century, this conflict between two men, William Perkins and Alexander Dixon, both Cambridge men, and how they came to this question of what's the proper way to remember something.
And this wasn't just a friendly debate. It got heated.
This was no holds barred, throwdown kind of at your throat polemic.
It's amazing. As I was reading some of the stuff that you sent me on this, I was sketching some of these, writing some of these insults down because I said, well, this could be useful.
Save them for later. Right.
Right?
Well, it's very much like when we turn off the mic here in the vomitorium.
Yes, where it gets ugly.
On air, it's all roses and lollipops. But when we turn off that mic, Winkle.
If you people only knew. So our topic today is one of those things where we're tracing the thread of the classics across centuries, right? Where we have scholars looking back centuries, looking back to people like Cicero, to Aristotle, and really wrestling with some of these ideas. And my sense is we're at kind of a point in history where kind of Renaissance, post-Renaissance, where there's lots of new things happening. Lots of old ideas turning into new ideas. And so we're talking about theories of memory. How does one memorize things? What should that look like as a Christian, be it a Protestant or a Catholic?
Yes, exactly so. I think that's really well put because this is the time when all serious discussion was done in Latin, at least for a universal audience or an international audience, I would say. So all the things that we're talking about were originally written in Latin between Dixon and Perkins, between Giordano Bruno and Peter Ramus. So the end of the Renaissance, we're in the 1580s right now. The Reformation has come to England, but not with complete success. It's pre-Enlightenment, definitely a high point, a kind of an apogee of engagement with classics. That's exactly right.
fascinating time in history. We're also kind of on the cusp of lots of kind of technological revolution. We're getting down towards Galileo in the next century.
That's right.
Early 70s. So, I mean, there's huge changes going on, particularly in northern England. And if I end up remembering my history correctly, this is a time where the Mediterranean and the southern part of Europe is starting to kind of flag and flutter a little bit, but things are booming up in the north.
I think that's exactly right. The Renaissance begins, of course, in Italy as emigres move west out of Constantinople after the, you know, the 1453 fall of that city. They bring with them a lot of Greek knowledge to Italy. It then starts to move north with men like Erasmus and others. And so by the time of the 1580s, when this controversy over memory arises, the weight has definitely shifted quite a bit further north. So as we approach this topic of memory controversy in the 1580s, we step back and look a little bit at the history of the art of memory. And Jeff, where does that take us?
That takes us to Francis Yates, this book, The Three Latin Sources for the Classical Art of Memory. And let me just read a little bit from, I believe this is from chapter one. She writes, "The first basic fact which the student of the history of the classical art of memory must remember is that the art belonged to rhetoric as a technique by which the orator could improve his memory, which would enable him to deliver long speeches from memory with unfailing accuracy."
Hmm.
"And it was as a part of the art of rhetoric that the art of memory traveled down throughout the European tradition, in which it was never forgotten, or not forgotten until comparatively modern times, that those infallible guides in all human activities, the ancients, had laid down rules and precepts for improving the memory."
Hmm. So that's really fascinating, because the notion is, if you're going to give a speech, if you're going to be, say, a professor, you're going to be a teacher of any kind, maybe even a preacher, you have to be able to remember really accurately the things you have prepared for delivery.
Right.
And are you going to do it in a kind of haphazard or brute fashion? Or is there going to be a system to guide you?
I find this really fascinating, too. And we've talked, I think, on earlier podcasts, back when we were covering Homer, about kind of this notion of kind of a culture of memory.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're in a pre-literate culture or a pre-alphabetic culture,
right,
the premium on memory. Students will ask me when they've read a play by Euripides, and we talk about other things, and it seems like everybody can, you know, quote these lines from Euripides, and, you know, that if they saw this play once, how did that happen?
Mm-hmm.
Right? How did this filter through a culture like that? And I wonder if even during the Roman era, as, you know, maybe literacy is increasing, that the premium on cultivating memory becomes more important because it's less of kind of a natural part of their culture. I mean, I'm just thinking out loud here. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to hear what you think about that.
Yeah, so it definitely stands out, right? So a pre-literate culture like that, one in which the Homeric epics were written, or a culture in which there's only partial literacy, the time of Cicero and the other famous Roman orators, there is definitely a high premium on memory. And this carries through into the 16th century. This is why these controversies are animating such men as Perkins and Dixon. And the rest is because it's one thing to compose something brilliant, and the invention of the printing press allows your composition to go out, but there still is, in its unadulterated and intact form, but there's still something very immediate about hearing a person deliver a speech.
Hmm.
And that effect is only achieved if you can remember everything you intended to say.
Very, very true. Do you want to share with us this fascinating story that Yeats gives in this same chapter?
Yes. So here in the chapter of The Art of Memory, she talks about the poet Simonides. So I'm going to quote this. "At a banquet given by a nobleman of Thessaly named Scopas, the poet Simonides of Chios chanted a lyric poem in honor of his host, but including a passage in praise of Castor and Pollux. Scopas meanly told the poet that he would only pay him half the sum agreed upon for the panegyric, and that he must obtain the balance from the twin gods to whom he had devoted half the poem."
Wow.
That's cold, isn't it?
That is cold.
That's cold school, I would say. "A little later, a message was brought in to Simonides that two young men were waiting outside who wished to see him. Simonides rose from the banquet and went out, but could find no one. During his absence, the roof of the banqueting hall fell in, crushing Scopas and all the guests to death beneath the ruins. The corpses were so mangled that the relatives who came to take them away for burial were unable to identify them. But Simonides remembered the places at which they had been sitting at the table and was therefore able to indicate to the relatives which were their dead. The invisible callers, Castor and Pollux, had handsomely paid for their share in the panegyric by drawing Simonides away from the banquet just before the crash. This experience suggested to the poet the principles of the art of memory, of which he is said to have been the inventor.
What a great story. I had not come across this one before we were putting the topic together. So not only does Simonides benefit, his memory helps him remember all these, the poetry, but he can remember where every person was sitting who got crushed by the roof.
Right.
And I can see Skopas getting it, right? But why did everybody else have to die? We've talked about the justness or the unjustness of the gods.
Yes.
Here, right?
It's collateral damage. I guess the gods decided there was no way to make the roof fall, without including everyone else in Scopus' demise.
Yeah, and Castor and Pollux show up. It's almost a little biblical, these two angels outside.
To rescue him.
Who pay handsomely. I wish it was more specific about the cash.
Right. Game.
But Simonides was
thinking about
rewarded.
A sponsorship, maybe?
Yeah.
Castor and Pollux,
exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the twins.
So we go from here, Jeff, down into the Roman era, right? So we start out with Simonides. We get the Greek perspective a little bit on the origins of the art of memory. What happens next?
Well, let's go back to the Yeats text once again.
She's very reliable.
She's very
she?
Reliable and a little Quintilian, if you will.
I will.
And so Yeats continues, the first step was to imprint on the memory a series of loci or places. The commonest, though not the only type of mnemonic place system used was the architectural type. The clearest description of the process is that given by Quintilian. In order to form a series of places in memory, he says, a building is to be remembered, a spacious and varied a one as possible. The forecourt, the living room, bedrooms, and parlors, not omitting statues and other ornaments with which the rooms are decorated. The images by which the speech is to be remembered, as an example of these, Quintilian says, one may use an anchor or a weapon, are then placed in imagination on the places which have been memorized in the building.
Hmm. So he's constructing a kind of a memory palace, which is a term with which some of our readers may be familiar. And the concept is that it's easier to remember several things than it is to remember one thing. This is shocking and counterintuitive.
It is.
If you want to remember someone's phone number, don't try to remember the phone number. Try to remember some anchor image, so to speak. And Quintilian recommends a building. So you have built in your mind a building, a house, something like that. Each one has a distinct room. In each room is some distinct object. And then you attach that phone number to that object. Then when you go searching for it, you're not starting de novo from scratch, but you are using the process of association.
That is so interesting. You know, I have a colleague at where I teach who takes great pride in his ability to learn his students' names within the first day. And so he teaches classes, and so each semester he has about 200 students.
Hmm.
And he's told me a similar kind of thing. I mean, he's not associating each student with like a room in a house, but he says, I'll pick something small and distinctive about each of them, something on their face, something that they were wearing, and he'll use that as a trigger. And I still don't really know how he does it, but he's able to remember their names, and next class he can greet them all by name.
That is really impressive.
Yeah.
I bet he gets great evaluations.
He does. Yeah. Yes, exactly. I'm quite envious.
I was first introduced to this concept 1994 at a conference. Someone was using this mnemonic technique, and he remembered everyone's name in the room as well, and he explained this memory palace idea. So this is somewhat familiar, but where it's going to take us in the course of this episode is to some unexpected ends, because our man William Perkins rejects this system altogether.
So Dave, get us into a little bit of the background of William Perkins. Who was this guy?
Right. So the conflict between these two men, Perkins and Dixon, right, comes in the early 1580s. So William Perkins was born in 1558. For a little bit of context, this is the year before Calvin's final edition of his Institutes. He was an English Protestant, Perkins was. He was educated at Cambridge. He's best remembered as a prolific essayist, and he was a nascent leader of the Puritan movement under Elizabeth I. So 1581 or so, this is the typical date for his conversion to Reformed views, and 3 years later, he was elected as the Fellow of Christ's College at Cambridge. He was later appointed as a lecturer at St. Andrew's Church in Cambridge in 1586, and he had an untimely death of gallstone infection in 1602. This is not so different than the way that Calvin died from a kidney stone infection.
Oh, he did? I didn't know that.
Yeah, 1564.
Is there anything else about Perkins that's relevant here to our discussion?
Well, I think for sure. Perkins lectured on philosophy and theology at Cambridge, and he pastored many students, including such luminaries as Thomas Goodwin and William of Ames. Where was he from again?
William of Ames?
Yeah.
I think he was from Ames?
He was from Ames. From Gulielmus Amesius. The former, that is Thomas Goodwin, was an intimate friend and advisor to Oliver Cromwell and a member of the Westminster Assembly. And Ames, after finishing at Cambridge, he went on and held a position at the University of Franeker in the Netherlands. Perkins, through his teaching and his essay writing, emerged as the English Calvin, they called him, the principal architect of the Puritan movement.
So the English Calvin, that's not your term?
That's a generally accepted and understood moniker for Perkins. He was the most successful author of his era in England and was really popular in New England as well. So Perkins knew his scholasticism quite well, the scholastic method. He was interested, as most scholars were, in all manners of intellectual and pedagogical debates, and this is how he got involved in the debate about memory.
So his ideas on memory aren't the thing he's most remembered for.
You say they're not the most.
They're not the most.
Definitely not.
Okay.
Most people wouldn't know that he wrote anything on memory.
Well, that's what makes this episode that we're doing essential, don't you say?
Oh, yes.
Yes. Now, what about his esteemed opponent in all of this?
Alexander Dixon?
Yeah, what do you know about him?
Well, much less is known about Dixon than Perkins, but he too was born in 1558, and he died sometime before 1604, so we have a terminus antiquum. Really interesting that Dixon served as a political agent for a man named Charles Neville, not to be confused with Aaron Neville. He was the 6th Earl of Westmoreland.
Aaron Neville? You're going there?
Yeah. I don't know much.
That's the song I was trying to get into my mind.
But I know Dixon. Neville was an English Catholic exiled from his homeland, and 7 years after this controversy, he himself converted to Catholicism. Now, the effect of this in the minds of Perkins and other Protestants was to confirm that Dixon's memory system was innately opposed to the Protestant concept of sola scriptura.
Would you agree with that?
Well, Perkins never says this directly. He never says, see, if you hold to this perverse, as he saw it, image-based memory system, you're going to go over to Rome. But many Protestants did see this as a confirmation of their own views on the topic.
Now, as I was reading up on this, I recognized that this really isn't a throwdown necessarily between Perkins and Dixon.
That's correct.
It's a war by proxy. And so Dixon is taking his cue from Giordano Bruno.
Correct.
And Perkins is defending Peter Ramus.
That's right. So these are the two protagonists behind the scenes, you might say.
Now, is this typical? I mean, do we see other stuff like this?
Oh, definitely.
So this is a standard fare for this era?
Yes, you have to come to the defense of whomever is your champion, your hero. So Ramus attacks Aristotle, and then others defend Aristotle.
Okay.
Right? Some people attack, say, Calvin, and then others come to the defense of Calvin, and it goes round and round. There's definitely, I don't want to say an entertainment element in order to belittle the real passions that lie behind these ideas, but the polemic and the invective is part of what motivates men of this time period.
Is there kind of a you know, in the ancient world, you know, there was an idea nobody would deign to outdo Homer, right?
Right.
You pay homage to Homer. Is there that kind of the element that, you know, Perkins and Dixon wouldn't say, well, I'm not going to put forth my own ideas because there are these giants.
Correct.
And so I'm going to stand kind of meekly on their shoulders. Well,
yeah.
Not meekly, but
right.
You would
Can
say
you
that's
stand
true?
Stand meekly on someone's shoulder?
It would be really awkward. Yeah.
I like the expression. Yeah, what you're saying is definitely true. The conventions of literary modesty entail that if you're going to trot out an idea, you have to connect it with someone that you consider greater, more experienced than yourself.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. So these persons stand in for their respective champions, Bruno and Ramus. Now, Bruno, like you said, he's an Italian. He's the earlier generation. He's born in 1548, and he follows the ideas of the Neoplatonists. This tradition never really died out, but it received a great surge of popularity during the Renaissance with men like Pico della Mirandola. It's one of my favorite salsas, and Marsilio Ficino. These are famous Florentine Neoplatonists.
I like that kind of salsa on my Ficino.
So Bruno developed his own system of artificial memory, and he used an image-based system, right? The traditional Quintilian Simonides kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then Bruno's innovation was to add to it, you ready for this?
I think so.
Combinatory wheels.
I have no idea what that is.
So if you are a listener, and you must be, you want to pause here in the episode and you want to write down I'm pretty sure this is the first time in any podcast the term combinatory wheel has been used.
Yeah, I'd put money on that too.
And to just up the ante a little bit more, we're going to mention another name, Ramon Lull.
Ramon.
Yes, Ramon. Good when the conversation has a dead spot, right?
Ramon? Yeah, no, the lull, yes.
That's cringy, isn't it?
That might be a little bit.
All right. All right. So Ramon Lull had these ideas of these combinatory wheels. That is a rotating platter. This is all in your imagination. And by manipulating these rotating platters, like the elements in a combination lock, you could manipulate your memory palace and spin the right part around when you needed it so you could access the object that you wanted.
So this is another way of doing your memory palace. So instead of a house, you have these giant platters.
Yes, take a giant house, your special architectural design, place it on a merry-go-round, or the kind of turntable you might have in the middle of your dining room table. Do people still use those?
Like a Lazy Susan?
Yeah, I don't know if the term Lazy Susan is really where we want to go with this.
Oh, that might not be correct.
I don't know.
So can we go, let's go with Lazy Steve.
why should Susan be the lazy one?
Exactly.
So, picture this. You have in your mind this Lazy Steve, on which is perched your architectural memory palace. Round and round it goes, and whenever you need to access something you have forgotten, like the thread of this podcast, the combinatory wheel stops and the object desired steps out on cue.
This is fascinating. I don't see how this is an improvement over the house metaphor, though.
Well, this is because it allows you to layer your memory palaces. You can stack Steves on Steves, and round and round they whirl.
So you got a stack of Steves, and you can all turn them in different directions and to call up what you need?
Correct.
Okay.
That's basically the image.
All right, I'll buy that.
Yeah. Are we going to be able to get through this?
I don't know. This is tough.
So that's Giordano Bruno, right? Drawing on Ramon Lull. So Bruno combines basic Neoplatonism with some Ramon Lull. He throws in a little Kabbalah, things of that nature. Alexander Dixon inherits it all, and then he writes two really scintillating works on memory in quick succession, and these come out in 1583 and 1584. The first one is called De Umbra Rationis, a sketch of method, or the shadow of reason. Now, translating umbra as shadow doesn't really work. He's talking about a kind of a system or a silhouette of method. That's maybe a better way to take umbra. And this is a direct borrowing from Bruno's other work, De Umbris Idearum, images or shadows of ideas.
Now, Dave, you mentioned there was a second work as well?
Yes, so this was 1584, a year later, a Defensio pro Alexandro Dixono, that is a defense for Alexander Dixon. This was published anonymously, and it was because in between these two, Perkins had attacked him.
I see. We're going to get around to Peter Ramus.
Yes, man behind Perkins.
Man behind Perkins. But before we get there, we have to pause for a word from our sponsors.
That's right. This episode of Ad Nauseam is brought to you by Hackett Publishing. Located in Indianapolis, Indiana, and Cambridge, Massachusetts, Hackett Publishing has been an independent publisher of high-quality translations in the field of classics, as well as many other corners of the humanities. Jeff, what do you think about Hackett and its titles?
I love Hackett stuff. Hackett's growing list of classics includes hundreds of titles covering ancient history, literature, philosophy, political science, classical language study. Hackett editions are ideal for both classroom use, general readership, offering affordable modern translations and editions of classic works with helpful scholarly notes, annotations, and introductions.
I like their classical lit backlist as well. I've used their translations in my courses to teach on Homer, to teach Virgil, Ovid's Metamorphoses, and they even have a new verse rendering of Gilgamesh. Who would render Gilgamesh in verse?
A very difficult task.
Yeah, Stanley Lombardo.
Yeah, he's the man.
Brought to us by Hackett.
So Dave, why don't you drop the goods on our loyal listeners? What's the dessert here at Shea Ad Nauseam?
Well, listeners can receive a 20% discount off any order and receive free shipping from Hackett Publishing. All they have to do is go to Hackett Publishing, HACKETT.com, find the text they want, enter the special code AN2021-2021 in the box, which asks for the coupon code.
It's a great deal. Listeners, don't hesitate. Check out HackettPublishing.com today.
Yes, check it out.
Today's episode is also brought to you in part by the good people at Ratio Coffee. Ratio Coffee has been building premium pour-over coffee machines for several years now. Dave, what do you like about the Ratio?
Jeff, I absolutely love the strong, mind-clearing brew that the Ratio gives. The instructions say to grind your beans to the consistency and texture of raw sugar. Then while the superheated water comes down the pipe at 200 degrees Fahrenheit and through the Fibonacci head, it off-gasses all those nasty carbon dioxide fumes and puts the sweet brew right into my heavy-grade carafe. The consistency of this coffee is amazing.
Now, I understand that the Big Daddy Ratio 8 has such popular demand that it's presently not available?
That's right, it's on back order even, but Ad Nauseam listeners can receive a 15% exclusive discount on its little brother, the Ratio 6. This amazing machine is all stainless steel and engineered to truly exacting specifications. So why throw away good money? Jeff, you want to throw away any good money?
I'm not up for that.
All right. Why throw away good money on some of these lesser products that come in plastic no better than the box they're shipped in? Put this baby, the Ratio 6, on your countertop, and you won't buy another coffee maker for at least a generation.
Yeah, these things are works of art.
Yes, these things are amazing, Jeff. So how can our listeners get this deal?
Our listeners should go to ratiocoffee.com and enter the special code ANCO. And so between now and March 20, listeners can go to ratiocoffee.com and enter the special code ANCO and get 15% off the Ratio 6. And listeners should also be aware that 4 out of 5 guys named Steve prefer Ratio Coffee. All right, Dave, so let's hear a bit about Peter Ramus, the guy who Perkins championed.
Right. So Peter Ramus, a Frenchman, Pierre de la Remée, something along those lines, born in 1515, died in 1572. This was kind of a wunderkind. He was a prodigious scholar, an early academic sensation in France, and a gifted controversialist.
A gifted controversialist?
Yes.
In what way?
Well, he loved controversy and he was good at it.
Okay.
And after every controversy, he gave a gift. His early lectures attacked Aristotle's system of logic. And as Pozzo writes, the young Ramus maintained that the transmitted doctrines of Aristotle are either fictitious or false.
Now, I got to ask here. So in my sense, we're talking at a time period that I don't know a ton about. Again, it reminds me of like Galileo,
right?
Not long after this, you know, whose cosmological system was in some ways a takedown of Aristotle's model.
Definitely.
So is this all part of this kind of wave? Is Aristotle kind of falling out of favor?
Well, in some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. If listeners are familiar with names like Basil Hall and Richard Muller, then they know that there's quite a great dispute about where Aristotle stood in the 16th century. Aristotle had been so important in the thought of guys like Thomas Aquinas and other scholastics, and so he was really in the ascendant until the beginning of the 16th century. But then the launch of the Reformation, Luther and so forth, the old view was that this was a strong reaction to Aristotle and scholasticism. Because you can read in Martin Luther these really outlandish Lutheran kind of statements that to be a Christian is not to be an Aristotelian.
Hmm.
But I think that's kind of to be taken with a grain of salt, frankly, because Luther just liked his bombastic expressions.
He was a gifted controversialist.
Definitely, right. And I think somewhere online there's a Luther insult generator. You can enter someone's name and it will spit out for you automatically.
Oh, I gotta cue that up.
Yes,
that sounds great.
A kind of insult that Luther would dispense. So on the one hand, Protestants were careful to discount some aspects of Aristotle's system they didn't like. But all of them continued using Aristotle, including William Perkins. He was well-trained in the scholastic method. But for a short period of time, this guy Peter Ramus was very popular and successful. He wrote his Aristotelian negative observations. This was in 1543, when Ramus was 28 years old.
Wow.
He was a really gifted speaker. At one point, he drew a crowd as large as 2,000 individuals. And by a strange coincidence of history, Ramus's name in Latin means
branch.
Branch.
Yeah.
Right. So the system of logic that he developed called Ramism is an endlessly branching division, subdivision, sub-subdivision, sub-sub-subdivision, and so on and so forth.
It's almost too perfect. Was that his real name?
It is really his name, Pierre de la Remée.
That's perfect.
But he, my daughter always criticizes my pronunciation of French, but...
Oh, your daughter is better with French than you are?
Oh, yeah. She knows some French. So really? Whenever I try to use some French, she lets me have it.
I gotcha.
So Ramus enjoyed this brief period of extreme popularity.
Okay.
He was kicked out of France, went to Geneva, because he was so popular, went to Geneva, where he was received by Theodore Beza, Calvin's successor. And later, going back to France, he died in 1572 in the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre.
So, Dave, tell us about Ramus's ideas on memory, or his theory of memory that Perkins gravitated toward.
Well, Ramus officially rejected the image-based system and all the combinatory wheels and all that sort of thing.
None of it?
No. Okay. He thought it was unnatural. He thought it also tended to a kind of moral extreme, because part of the image system was premised on the idea that the more ridiculous the image you put in your mind, the easier it is to remember.
Okay.
So say like a pig attached to a horse, a pig horse. The front's a pig, the back's a horse. Or when people say, try not to think of a pink elephant, right? You've heard that.
Yes.
Immediately, what do?
You think of a pink elephant.
You think of a pink elephant. It's kind of unavoidable. And there are even expressions in Aquinas that say that thought is impossible without an image. There's a famous Aquinas quote to that effect. So Ramus is reacting against this and says, let's purge our minds of all of these ridiculous images altogether, and let's have our memory-based system be one that's purely dialectical and rational. Let's memorize propositions. So we have proposition X, we have proposition X1, X2, X3. From X3, we have propositions Y1, Y2, Y3. And so you have an endlessly branching system of propositions to remember.
I see. Now, that might work better. It strikes me as a lot less interesting than the platters.
Well, I don't think it works better, honestly. There does seem to me to be something unnatural about it. So the real question is, why did Perkins gravitate toward it?
Yeah. Do we have an answer for that?
Well, the answer, according to Francis Yates, whom I think is very reliable, lies in this issue. That Perkins, as an iconoclast, this is part of the Protestant movement, we're going to purge the churches of all images.
Hmm.
Sometimes iconoclasm took violent forms. Sometimes it was more mild. You know, the priceless pieces of art were moved out of the churches. They were preserved and they were displayed in non-religious contexts. But the underlying spirit of iconoclasm is a part of the Protestant faith. So if we're going to get rid of these physical things that we look at, let's not clog our minds up. This is the reasoning. Let's not clog our minds up with images for the purpose of memory.
Yeah, right. So it's if you were to compare like walking into St. Peter's in the Vatican with walking into kind of an early Calvinist church in Switzerland, the contrast is staggering.
Yes, right? The aesthetic is very, very different.
Right. So in the Calvinist church, you'd find just maybe a simple table,
mm-hmm.
something for the Eucharist and the
a
Bible.
A pulpit.
Yeah,
and Bible on the pulpit.
Right. And nothing on the walls.
No.
Yeah.
There is a Protestant aesthetic. Even many Protestants I know don't find it appealing. But the Protestant aesthetic is simplicity, right? You have hard-grained wood. You have things that are symmetrical and neat and orderly.
Hmm.
It's a very different aesthetic than you can find in any Catholic cathedral. All right, so as we approach this question of how Perkins deals with memory, he approaches it from the vantage point of the scholastic method.
Right.
So, Jeff, I understand you're going to share with our listeners a little bit about what the scholastic method is.
Yes. So the scholastic method in the university system of the 16th century proposed that for any given topic, there were four relevant questions.
You're going to break out some Latin?
I'm going to break out a little Latin here.
All
Why
right.
not? Right. So question one, quae est quaestio? What is the question? Two, qui est quaestionis status? What is the state of the question?
Mm-hmm.
Number three, quae sunt objectiones? What are the objections to the question? And four, quae sunt responsiones? What are the responses?
Okay. So this is standard scholastic fare.
Yes.
All right. So what is it, right? What do people currently think about it? Objections and responses.
Yeah.
All right. So as Perkins enters this debate in response to Dixon's work, remember Dixon's work is defending Bruno, this is how he starts. And I'm going to read a little bit of Latin too.
Excellent.
All right. And then give a translation. So this is from his Anti-Dixonus. Memoriae facultas fornatissima vir, et satis tibi nota est per se, et ego illustriorem illam scribendo facere non possum, unum dicam in manera aliquid prudenter, et idem cum judicio dispensare et disponere in lauda vix ponendum esse, ni illud memoriae comprehensiona saepire possim. That's the Anti-Dixonus.
That's the Anti-Dixonus.
Yeah, Jeff, what do you think about Dixon?
I'm more or less, I'm anti-Dixon. Actually, I'm vehemently anti-Dixon.
Are you really?
Yeah.
So no Dixon in the Winkle household?
No, my boys know better than to bring up Dixon around me. I will fly off the handle. Right. I'm barely keeping it together right now. And what does that translate to?
Well, it'd be something like this. The faculty of memory, my most eminent friend, is both sufficiently well known to you in its own right, and such that I cannot render it more renowned by my literary effort. I will make only one remark, that if I should be able to discover something using wisdom, and judiciously share and promulgate it, that same thing can scarcely be considered praiseworthy unless I could hedge it round by the firm grasp of memory.
So he's talking about a method of memory, right?
Right.
So break that down for us. Unpack this.
Well, it's really different than the Bruno Dixon type, right? Of course, it's not based on images. He's going to follow Ramus and this propositional kind. So he says, again, this is a little quote from Perkins, "Let us imagine that a rustic and simple man is gripped by a zeal to acquire learning."
I can imagine that.
Okay. We there?
Yeah.
You got it on your
it's
Lazy
actually,
Steve?
The problem is it's an image in my mind right now.
It would be difficult, I believe, for his mind, that is the simple rustic man, to become softened up so as to receive useful sowings of learning. But if there is any hope introduced that he could become someone equipped with learning, it is method that will by itself produce almost that entire result. And lest anyone suppose that perhaps I am bestowing on method mere hollow praises, let him test my entire claim by the following example.
Okay, so it's a little condescending to the rustic guy, I think, but
perhaps.
So what's the example?
Well, he's going to talk about ethics. Here is Perkins' example of how to use his non-image-based system to remember the theory of ethics. He says, "Ethics is the instruction of how to live well. Living well means living according to virtue. In virtue we find the species. Virtues are either of the will, such as either those virtues that relate to the one who possesses them, i.e. gentleness in controlling anger, moderation in restraining pleasures." And under that subheading, we have the sub-subheadings. Moderation in restraining pleasures includes chastity, sobriety in food and drink. But we're not done yet. The second branching system are those virtues that are directed toward other persons. These include the two subheadings, the disposition of money as generosity. If generosity becomes too extensive, it is deemed ostentation. Then there are the virtues directed toward other persons as regards the law, such as that which justice determines and that which courage defends and guards.
Now, this explain this to me. How, in some ways, is this any different than if I were to put these all in little rooms in a house?
There's no images attained to these.
And that's the only thing.
Well, not only are there no images attached to any of these, but there has been a great deal of careful reflection given to how to divide and subdivide these topics down to the smallest level of granularity possible.
Okay. I guess I can admire and respect that. I think I'm turning more pro-Dixon as we go on, though. I need my platter.
Well, I'm not really in favor of this as a system of memory. It seems to me that the praiseworthy elements of this system are the careful critique and review. It's worthwhile to break everything down, but I don't really see how it's going to help you remember anything.
Yeah, exactly. Now, do you know, is he adding anything to Ramus here? Or is he just...
I think it's an imitation
of Ramus.
It's
an imitation, okay.
It's an application to some more theological ideas. He will show this in some of his later writings, specifically how this system can work to make someone a better preacher. But it doesn't seem like it's going to help the memory specifically.
No, I don't see that either.
So we've looked at the two different memory systems, the image-based one of Bruno Dixon, the propositional one of Ramus and Perkins. What kind of vitriol and polemic did Perkins bring down on Dixon?
That's such good stuff. I love how heated it gets. It's so ad hominem, right? And so it's great reading. Let me read a little bit from Perkins' polemic here. "It was once said, Dixon, that the image of Minerva was both seen and approved at the same time. In the case of your little book, things turned out so very poorly that I hear many saw the book, hardly anyone approved of it. If you want to know why, there are two obvious reasons, and these are readily apparent to everyone. First, its words, and second, its content."
That's how most reviews of my work go.
"That is so brutal." It says, "But your little book, did it have any blossom of pure style? Any gleam of clear and luminous speech? It surely did not, by Hercules, give off any aroma of Roman purity."
There's just a little bit more here I want to read.
Please.
Perkins asks of Dixon, exactly how large a ravenous abyss are you? How large a cash chasm? It is not proper for you to invite carefully chosen young men into your school by promising them the very heights and by explaining your childish trifles only to peel off from them as much money as you can. And so your greed and avarice should take a breather for a while. Stop finally making so great and rich a profit from your trifles, unless you truly wish to win for yourself the kind of ignominy that the life to come will never wash away.
I can't help but to recognize that this says nothing about his theory of memory.
No, right? No. It's reminiscent of a topic we covered not too long ago, which is Cicero against Mark Antony.
Exactly. It sounds very much like his Philippics.
Course.
Yes.
Yeah, well, these men learned to read Latin on the first Catilinarians and on the Philippics and so forth.
So no coincidence.
No, definitely not.
No, that's great. Did he call him a cash chasm?
Cash chasm.
That is great. Yeah.
So then just to sum up Perkins here, before we get on to some of the funny specifics of how you, listener, can have a better memory, Perkins says, indeed, along with Peter Ramus, I maintain that the perfect art of memory either has not yet been discovered, or if any such thing can exist by nature, logical disposition itself is it.
That's the key.
That's it.
Okay.
Logical disposition.
All right.
So you know how to divide, subdivide, chop, subchop, everything down into its finest granular particles.
Okay.
And remember it that way, proposition after proposition. Is that going to work for you, Winkle?
It's not going to work for me, because I want to know things that I can do, maybe some things I could eat that might help me. So I can maybe do an end run around the logical disposition part.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Perkins has some good advice for us there.
Yes, he does. So these are some of the things that Perkins says you stay away from.
If
you don't want to destroy your memory, don't do these things.
These are the things to avoid.
Things to avoid,
the
right.
The no-no list.
Yes. So he says, avoid diverse anxieties, a little bit general.
Okay.
The indiscriminate reading of books.
No helluari libris.
No, and it makes me worried for you, because I know you have like a pile of books that you're always going through.
I do. I like to read a lot of different books.
But it's discriminate, isn't it?
Nah, I think it's probably indiscriminate.
Okay. You better, Perkins says watch it.
Okay. All right.
Excessive modesty.
I'm not given to that. So don't be too modest.
Not too modest. Sluggishness.
Okay.
Excessive sleep.
No problem.
Sleeping while lying down.
Well, see, that's one of my favorites.
How else are you supposed to do it?
I sometimes sleep in a chair, honestly. And apparently in the time of Abraham Lincoln, people thought that if you slept lying down, it was bad for your health. So they would sleep sitting up in bed.
Okay. So that's what Perkins is doing? He's
sleeping, I don't know.
Okay.
What else?
Inebriation. That seems like
That's an obvious one.
Excessive sex.
Okay.
Studying too late into the night.
Guilty.
Students. Onions.
Stay away from onions.
Onions. Walnuts.
Wait a minute.
I just read walnuts are a superfood.
Back up now.
Well, onions.
Please. Why do onions destroy the memory?
I don't know. I don't see the connection at all.
Well, they create a kind of a stench.
Yeah.
Right? They keep on your breath. They're a distraction.
Make you cry.
But they're kind of like combinatory wheels, aren't they?
Oh, maybe that's what it is.
A wheel within a wheel?
A wheel within a wheel, yes.
Walnuts,
platters.
You were saying.
Walnuts, large meals, washing of the head and putting the head underwater.
Right.
So no bathing or showering or swimming for Billy here.
Yep.
And hair that is too long.
That's a surprising one.
I can see him wagging his finger, those long hairs, right?
Well, but not for, reasons that might seem more current, but because it destroys the memory. It
destroys the memory, right?
As the hair grows out, the thoughts go with it.
Right. Well, it's the opposite of Samson. Well, I don't know, Samson wasn't remembered for me all that bright, but
you should have seen Samson on Trivia Night.
Now, what about some good things? What can we do to preserve our memory?
That may have been a little irreverent. And that's a no-no for me. Things that preserve the memory. You ready?
Yep.
Eating the brain of rooster. Eating the brain of pigeon and the brain of partridge.
I mean, what I'm assuming here by eating the brains, you're absorbing the powers of memory of a pigeon?
Superfoods?
All right.
Yep.
Okay.
Coriander seed boiled in vinegar and coated in sugar.
Tasty.
You have there basically a recipe. So take coriander, boil it in vinegar, and then coat it in sugar. This helps preserve your memory.
Okay.
Quince apple preserves, it's kind of jam, taken at supper or at lunch.
Okay, I'm down with that.
Not breakfast, that'll ruin your memory.
No, don't do that. Yeah,
the aromas of aloe, crowned betony, rosemary flowers, nigella, thorny rose, basil, spikenard, honeysuckle flowers, lavender, cicera, Benedict's thistle, taken with food.
It reminds me of that. Have you kind of heard about this kind of this craze right now for essential oils?
I have.
Right. So if you have a scent in your house,
careful, Winkle. We're going to alienate our audience.
Well, I'm just describing. I'm not critiquing. But you know, it's like the scent of peppermint is good for achy joints or something like that.
Well, I have a confession here. As I'm at home working on the translating of Latin, I often have a couple candles going.
Okay.
Because I like the smell.
Do you have a favorite scent?
Whatever is cheapest at the grocery store.
Crowned Bettany?
No. Yeah. Wherever I, you know, my candle supplier, and Yankee, if you're listening, here's a sponsorship opportunity. So what I have going right now is cinnamon rolls.
Ooh.
And lavender.
Nice.
And they don't mix that nicely.
Oh, I know.
Other things that preserve the memory, oil of castor.
Which is Latin for beaver.
Okay.
Yeah.
Euphorbia. Lily of the valley, distilled with strong wine and sipped in very small quantities.
Yeah, take it easy.
Each of these things will preserve your memory.
Okay.
The other things will destroy it.
Okay. All right. We're up against the clock once again. We got to get out of here, Dave. So help us wrap this up.
Right. So the tendrils of classics, Aristotle, Metrodorus of Skepsis, Simonides, these guys, these tendrils reach right down into the 16th century, right down to Cambridge. We have these men, William Perkins, famous preacher, the English Calvin. We have Alexander Dixon, a Scot. They're duking it out as avatars for Giordano Bruno and Peter Ramus. All of them writing in Latin, insulting in Latin, walnutting in Latin. And we've also given the listener, I think it's fair to say, right, Jeff?
Yes.
We've given them a surefire recipe for maintaining their own memories.
Oh, yeah, more than they could possibly use.
You're going to go with combinatory wheels and Lazy Steves.
I'm going with Lazy Steves. I'm pro Dixon at this point.
Okay.
Yeah, but I mean, talk to me tomorrow, maybe.
I'm going to keep my head out of water, keep my hair not too long, and I'm going to enjoy the logical disposition that Perkins suggests.
Excellent. We'll have to compare notes and see how we do.
So, Jeff, if listeners have liked this episode, what do you think they ought to do?
Well, they should go to whatever platform they're using. It really helps us if you leave us a nice review, subscribe to our podcast, drop us a note. You can contact us directly if you have comments for Dave, dave@adnauseum.com. Don't forget a V there instead of the U. Or you can write to me at jeff@adnauseum.com. Check out the website. Check out our Lurch with Merch section. We got some really great T-shirts and apparel for you to buy. What are we doing next week?
Well, next week is going to be the first of a two-parter. We're going to look at the famous Battle of Thermopylae.
Oh, I'm excited about this.
Yeah, the Battle of Thermopylae was the fall of 480. We're going to do two parts on that. Specifically, we're going to look at a famous book by the historian Peter Green. How historical are the events of Thermopylae that we've been told about?
Right. It's a question I often get from students. It's like, hey, how can we trust this? How do we know this is real?
How much should we believe? And Jeff, you get the gustatory parting shot, don't you?
I do. This week it comes from Miguel de Cervantes, the author of Don Quixote, who once said, "All sorrows are less with bread."
Ah, thanks for listening.
Thank you.